While much of the debate surrounding the criminal justice issues in Albany during the final days of the legislative session revolved around policies affecting adult New Yorkers, state lawmakers also approved measures designed to serve younger New Yorkers, too. For an explanation on those bills affecting juveniles, which are now waiting to be sent to the governor for his signature, we're joined by Lisa Freeman, Director of Special Litigation for the Juvenile Rights Practice at the Legal Aid Society. Welcome to the show, Lisa.
Thanks so much for having me.
So the first bill I want to talk about has to do with raising the lower age of juvenile delinquency jurisdiction from 7 to 12. What is happening to kids in that window currently, and how will they be treated in the future if this becomes law?
So from our vantage point, this is really a no-brainer and consistent with the efforts that have been made to really right-size the juvenile justice system in New York. Kids as young as 7 to this day can be prosecuted as juvenile delinquents, which means that they can be arrested, they can be handcuffed, they can be taken in police cars into custody, they can be detained with older youth. Kids under 12 under this bill will no longer be treated that way. This essentially means that those children will be provided with services that already exist in our child welfare system and in our preventive services and social services network, rather than being treated as juvenile delinquents.
What sort of circumstances would, say, a 10-year-old today find himself potentially under arrest and in the back of a cop car?
Any act that would be considered a crime for an adult is an act that a child could be prosecuted for under the current law. A child as young as 10, a child as young as 7.
And are we finding that that is how police typically handles this sort of stuff, or do they try to pursue other alternatives?
So I really can't speak to whether the current practice, you know, across the state is consistent. Mm-hmm. However, police have the ability to incarcerate kids, to handcuff them, to treat them, you know, as they do adult criminals or adult criminal suspects. The larger concern here is that it's really a traumatizing experience for young children to be treated that way. We're talking about elementary school children, and it really feeds the school-to-prison pipeline. It also is a matter of racial justice because, quite frankly, you know, more privileged kids, if they engage in acts that are otherwise, you know, violations of the law, do not typically get arrested or put through the system. They're handled in other ways. And really, this is just a question of treating all children the same and ensuring that children aren't traumatized needlessly. At this point in time, there are about 1,000 children across New York State that are arrested each year under age 12 or 12 and under. The statistics actually are for 12 and under, although the bill would only address kids under 12. Of those, only about 121, I believe, in 2019 were actually prosecuted in family court. So the vast majority of them never even reach court. And so it's completely absurd to subject kids to this intensely traumatic experience of being arrested when the system itself recognizes that that's not the right way to handle these kids once you know, these kids get to the system. So this bill would really go a long way to reducing the school-to-prison pipeline, enhancing racial justice, and treating children as children.
If this legislation does become law, does New York currently have enough invested in the alternative services that these kids would now be relying on, or should we see a commensurate increase in investment in recognition of the fact that we're going to have a larger population going through this alternative system?
We think that there will be significant cost savings, that it's much more expensive to process a child through the juvenile delinquency system than it is with social services. The social services are really already in place to address these any needs that these children have. And in fact, you know, as I mentioned, because so few of the cases actually wind up in going through the family court, these kids, for the most part, are being diverted to these services already. It's just a question of ensuring that that process is consistent across the board.
Another bill that made its way through both houses recently has to do with the determination of youthful offender status. What is the issue there, and what is the legislative fix?
Certain young adults are eligible for what's called youthful offender status, which means that they would not wind up with a criminal record if they are given that status. And that status is typically at the discretion of the judge at the time of sentencing. What this bill would allow is 5 years after a person has completed their sentence, or 5 years after they've been released from jail or prison, that they can apply to reconsider the denial of youthful offender status. So in other words, someone who was not granted youthful offender status by the judge at the time of sentencing can come back to court and say, take a look at how I have rehabilitated myself, take a look at everything I've done, and please give me the benefit of that status now. And what that does is it provides protection going forward so that that person doesn't then have a criminal record and can go on to be a more successful person in our society, doesn't suffer all the collateral consequences that come with the criminal record.
You're listening to the Capitol Press Room, and we're talking about legislative efforts to address the criminal justice system for juveniles. And our guest is Lisa Freeman, Director of Special Litigation for the Juvenile Rights Practice at the Legal Aid Society. You mentioned, with regards to the juvenile delinquency jurisdiction issue, that kids of color fare worse than white kids in terms of how they're treated when they might face potential for arrest, because the ability of a judge to offer youthful offender status is up to their discretion. Is this another system where young white people typically fare better than young people of color, and then thus this legislative fix would help level the playing field?
So we don't have the data as to the pool of people who request youthful offender status and are denied it, but we know that our criminal justice system suffers from rampant racial, injustice, and that the vast majority of people that are prosecuted through that system are Black or Latinx. So I have no doubt that this would benefit people of color to, a larger extent than it would white people, just because they are so disproportionately impacted by the criminal justice system.
If someone wanted to apply for retroactive youthful offender adjudication, is this something that they could navigate on their own, or would they likely need legal help? And if they did need legal help, what sort of help is out there?
Well, until this bill is passed, I don't think anyone has set up a system to assist people in need of these services. Mm-hmm. But I would expect that public defender offices would create a mechanism if, in fact, legal assistance is needed. I think it would probably depend in large part on whether the prosecuting agencies were consenting or were contesting the application. So there may be many instances where people can apply and are granted approval without any need for an in-depth hearing.
And finally, turning to a bill that didn't pass, but it's one that we've talked about on this show previously, but it's worth highlighting again. It has to do with procedures required for the custodial interrogation of children. Can you remind listeners what the issue is there?
The issue there is, again, one of racial fairness. If my child were arrested today, I would hire a private attorney right away who would invoke my child's Miranda rights before the law enforcement questioned my child. Children do not simply understand the consequences of waiving a constitutional right. No one would trust their child to make that kind of significant decision if given the choice. This bill would allow and ensure that kids were given consultation with an attorney before waiving their right to remain silent. So this is really, again, a question of adolescent brain development, that we recognize that kids don't have this capacity, and by ensuring that they are given counsel, we protect their rights and don't allow law enforcement to take advantage of the fact that they don't really understand what it means to waive that right.
That bill got to the precipice of getting a vote in the assembly. It essentially made it to the floor. In the Senate, though, it was really mired in the committee process. Any sense about what the holdup was? Because I would imagine that the majorities, the Democratic majorities in both houses, would be sympathetic to this issue. So why didn't this make it through?
You know, I'm really not sure. And in fact, I think we are optimistic that it will ultimately make it through. We really have not met with resistance. Even the Office of Court Administration has supported this bill. We have judges that have supported this bill. We have victims advocates that have supported this bill. So I think this bill hopefully will move in the near future.
But I mean, that would be 2022 at this point, with the legislative session over for now.
Yes, unless there is a miracle and they decide to hold a couple more days of session.
So turning, though, back to the pandemic and juvenile justice, I'm curious what issues at all you've seen arise as the result of the pandemic, just in the course of your work over the 15 months. Has this presented any new and additional complications?
Absolutely. The access to courts has been really limited during this time, and as a result, there are many cases that have not been filed, where children have been arrested, but the cases have not been filed. The upside of that is that we have seen that in many instances, these children have gone on to be successful members of their community without the case ever being prosecuted to date. So there's a lesson to be taken there, that less intrusion by the juvenile justice system can be really beneficial. On the other hand, for some children, they have been faced with a lack of opportunity to begin defending themselves, and that can mean the loss of relevant evidence. You know, memories get you know, weakened or erased over time. So if and when these arrests that were made result in prosecutions, many of these kids may be facing a more difficult path to their defense.
I imagine working at the Legal Aid Society and just being a advocate for people who are less advantaged than others is difficult in and of itself. But what's it like advocating for children who are trying to navigate the system and can potentially have their lives ruin before they even really start? Is that something that's, I guess, a heavy emotional toll for you?
It is. Most of my work is with regard to class action litigation and trying to change the system and do law reform efforts, such as the bills that we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. But certainly the people on the front line, day in and day out, really experience what's called secondary trauma. At times, from the daily grind of having to work with clients who are facing such significant challenges and under so much stress. So it's a difficult job.
We've been speaking with Lisa Freeman. She's the director of special litigation for the juvenile rights practice at the Legal Aid Society. Lisa, I really appreciate you walking me through all this.
Thanks so much for having me.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals in education, human services, and healthcare.
Join us again for Capitol Press Room, a production of WCNY Connected, Syracuse.